I'm speaking today with State Representative Craig Island, who represents the 21st District. I got that right, didn't I? The 21st District in Texas?
23rd.
I'm sorry. I always get those two confused for some reason in my head. Anyway, Representative Island, you have been in the legislature since, what was it, 1994?
I was elected in 94. First session to serve was 1995.
Looking back on your career, what would you say have been the high points? What would you say have been the things you've done as a state legislator that you're most proud of?
Well, probably the number one thing would be the response to Hurricane Ike and its impact on both Galveston Island, Galveston County, and Southeast Texas, and the work that we were able to do over the last two sessions to try to help the problems and the issues created by Ike.
Okay. What sorts of things did the legislature do to respond to that?
Well, the first and probably the biggest and long term would be make sure that UTMB was fully restored and hardened so that it can ride out any future storms on Galveston Island, as opposed to moving it to the mainland, moving it to Austin, or downsizing it significantly. So, and that was done by direct appropriations from the state for FEMA matching funds of $150 million, for tuition revenue bonds of $150 million to match some FEMA money of $600 million or so. In addition, as part of that plan, we had a local foundation, the C.D. Smith Foundation, donate approximately somewhere around $250 million to restore and rebuild Jenny City Hospital and restore John City Hospital. It's great these days to drive by UTMB's campus to see that there's cranes in the air. There's still patients in the bed, but there's cranes in the air so that we can, we're building for the future. And it's been hardened similar to the way, if you remember, Tropical Allison just completely decimated and flooded the medical center. And if you go to the medical center these days, on the first floor, basically the only thing you see is Starbucks and pianos and couches. And everything else begins on the second or third floor. That's what's occurring at UTMB with FEMA funds. And so it's all total. It's over $1.5 billion in construction. It may even be close to $1.8 billion by the time it's all over. And those are good jobs as well, staying here locally.
I mean, go ahead. I thought you were done, but go ahead.
In addition to just UTMB, we got significant funds for Texas A&M Galveston to help protect their docking area for their ships, and which had been having erosion problems for a long time, so we finally got a long-term solution to that. And then House Bill 4102, which provided funding for our schools and community colleges that had damage in both Galveston, actually Brazoria, Galveston, Chambers, and Jefferson counties received the most of the funding, but even Harris counties and schools like LaPorte got significant funding from that legislation as well. And that certainly eased the pain. It was hard for Chapter 41, Robin Hood giving districts to send millions of dollars away at the same time they're trying to rebuild the infrastructure and keep their schools open. So I was very proud of our work to give that relief.
Okay. I mean, UTMB was one of the big employers on the island, and when it looked like it was going to close down there, it was really catastrophic. But Galveston has sort of been coming back since then. What do you see as in the future for Galveston to rebuild its population, and what, if anything, can or should the legislature be doing to help that?
Well, I think the legislature, to a great extent, has done its part. We've got to make sure that all of that money is deployed at UTMB. We're still working on that, and I'm confident that it'll all be deployed. That's one. Second, Galveston is coming back with Tillman Fertitta opening the historical Pleasure Pier this summer. That just adds a whole new dimension, because now you've got Moody Gardens, you've got Schlitterbahn, you've got historical Pleasure Pier, you've got the beach, all right here in Houston's backyard. So that is all rock and rolling, wonderful. We've had the best summer ever from my conversations with the hotel and motel people, as well as the restaurants and bars. In addition, the port is really moving along. Everybody believes that the widening and deepening of the Panama Canal is going to be a multi-billion port. The ports of Houston and Galveston, and they're working together on some long-term plans, which I think would be great. In addition, we've got the Disney cruise that's going to be starting soon. And so everything is looking up. We still, obviously, as you read in the paper, there's still issues with the low-income housing and the Galveston Housing Authority, and issues going on between the federal government and the local housing authority. That'll eventually get itself worked out some way, but everything else is looking up and moving ahead, looking good.
Okay. You were on the Appropriations Committee in 2011, and this was as brutal a year budget-wise as we've seen in the legislature. Looking ahead, what hope is there to, reverse some of the budget cuts that were made in 2011? I mean, first of all, how do things look from a revenue perspective at this point?
Well, revenue is coming in greater than the comptroller, Susan Combs, had forecasted. Part of that is the economy is getting better, and a lot of it is the boom down in the Eagle Ford Shale down in South Texas. So the revenue picture looks better than anticipated. However, the legislature didn't completely fund any programs. It's, most specifically, everybody knows that the Medicaid, which pays our over 7,000 home beds in this state, are paid for by Medicaid. The doctors and hospitals, and over 50% of the burden, are paid for by Medicaid. So it's an important part of our health care network. It was only funded through about April of 2013. Everybody knows we have to go in, and any extra revenue is going to have to be put there first. And then we're going to, if that's not enough, we'll have to do something to finish out that budget year. So the long-term future is still unknown because of our school finance system being in litigation. We don't know what the outcome of that's going to be, but I wouldn't be surprised if it requires more funds going to our public schools. And then we still have the Medicaid demands on our budget. And then and that's coupled with the franchise tax, or the margin tax, which was in 2007 or so, underperforming even from its original projections, which were projected not to pay for everything, and not to be, it was projected not to be revenue neutral, in that it didn't raise enough money to offset the property taxes that it was to replace, but it even performed less than that, and that causes a strain on the entire budget, and there's no foreseeable end to that strain.
Okay. You know, talking about Medicaid, you know, Governor Perry talks about Medicaid being this great devourer of the state budget, and he used that as one of his justifications for not doing the expansion of Medicaid provided for by the Affordable Care Act that would, you know, enable the state to cover a whole lot of the current, you know, the many millions of people that currently don't have health insurance in Texas. You know, let me hear your perspective on the impact of Medicaid on the budget and what it would mean to accept or reject, you know, the federal funds for expanding Medicaid.
Well, I think for Texas, the number one issue is that we need to have flexibility on how we spend the Medicaid dollars. It is such a large part of our state budget, and we have such a diverse population with different needs all over the state. The needs down in Brownsville and South Texas are much different than the needs in Dallas and Lubbock and Amarillo, Texarkana, even Houston. So we need, and I supported trying to get as much flexibility as we can get. I think hopefully eventually if the Affordable Health Care Act stays in place and proceeds, that we will someday expand the Medicaid population or allow our local regions like Harris County Hospital District to expand it and have as much flexibility on how we use those funds to deliver health care and pay our doctors and hospitals for delivering the health care that's obviously needed. And hopefully, I know that former Representative and Senator Janik from the Houston area, who's now going to be Health and Human Services Commissioner on September 1st, hopefully he's got some ideas of how we can accomplish that.
I mean, Governor Perry talks about block grants as being the way he would accept it. What's your opinion on that?
Well, that's one way of describing kind of the ultimate flexibility. Hopefully we could get that kind of flexibility, but if we can't get that much, hopefully we can get more than we have now.
I mean, as I understand it, the problem with block grants is that, you know, once the money runs out, there's nothing else.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it seems to me like, I mean, there's flexible and there's maybe, it seems to me like that's a backdoor way of cutting it, isn't it?
Yeah, and I don't see how we can cut Medicaid anymore. Our physicians and hospitals are not taking new patients as it is. And, you know, our nursing homes last session simply run the numbers, and if you keep cutting them, they just can't keep their doors open. And so there is a point where we reach maximum cuttings, and we have to do something else besides just cut.
It seems like an idea that is being circulated amongst certain areas of the political world is to replace the property tax with an increased sales tax. What do you think about that?
I don't know. I haven't seen the details of any proposals. You know, we've had those ideas come up in the past. It's very hard to get any type of tax increase past the legislature, any type of increased sales tax. If there's anything that's done, it would definitely have to be an offsetting in this current environment, the current makeup of the legislature. It would have to be a revenue neutral tax swap. And it depends on what you expand the sales tax to and how much the property taxes are reduced. But there has to be a recognition that our current tax system from the state level is going to continue to, is probably going to continue putting pressure on our counties, our school districts, and our cities to make up for shortfalls from the state because of the lack of funds. And one area that I believe we're going to start seeing it more and more is our transportation. The gasoline tax just cannot provide funds necessary to keep our roads and highways maintained, much less expanded.
You were also on the insurance committee. Texas has pretty high rates. Consumers pay pretty high rates of insurance in Texas. Homeowners, auto, all of it. Is the regulatory system that we have in place for insurance in Texas, is it working? What do we need to do about this?
Oh man.
I realize that's an easy question.
No, I just saying we need about 3 hours for this discussion. We have the regulatory system in Texas currently that the insurance companies want. When it was passed, they said that this would help keep rates low and coverage available. I think that we have a pretty good auto insurance market with lots of carriers and lots of different pricing capabilities. But when it comes to homeowners, Texas is not a good place to be a homeowner insurance policy purchaser because the rates just keep going up, and oftentimes the rates go up and your coverage is reduced and your deductible is increased.
I mean, one of the effects of Hurricane Ike was to put severe strain on the windstorm insurance, I believe the windstorm insurance industry and the amount of money that was available to deal with that. Where do things stand with that now?
Well, Texas Windstorm Insurance Association, commonly known as TWIA, is supposed to be the insurer of last resort for the 14 coastal counties and part of Harris County. It has become basically the insurer of the only resort because the insurance companies have just dumped almost every homeowner windstorm policy into TWIA at an accelerating rate, beginning even before Hurricane Ike. And it's not just a Texas problem, it's a national problem where they use the coastal areas as a buffer zone to simply not write coverage. They know that if there's a storm that hits Galveston, they're going to have a lot of claims in Houston, so they just use that Galveston and Chambers County as a buffer zone to their claims. Same goes for Corpus, Brazoria County. But to me, there's absolutely no excuse for the insurance company not to be writing homeowners policies with wind in Friendswood and in Pearland. Those places are solid built homes, new construction, and they're 25 to 30 miles from the beach. It's, but here they are, they continue to dump those homeowners into TWIA. And then you've got State Farm, who earlier this year stopped writing homeowners at all. Not, you know, before this spring, they would say, look, we'll write your homeowners, but we're not going to cover your wind. You got to buy that through TWIA. We're not going to write your flood. You got to buy that through the federal flood insurance program. But we'll write your homeowners policy for fire, theft, vandalism, liability. Well, earlier this year, they just canceled 11,000 policy owners. And it wasn't because they wanted more premium. It wasn't because the people made claims. And it wasn't because the agent wasn't profitable. And it wasn't because the town wasn't profitable. It was simply that several years ago, they drew a line in the sand and said, we're not going to cover anything in any state that will let us avoid it within a half mile of a major body of water, whether that's the beach, the bay, or Clear Lake, or Lake Michigan. And they just moved that line further inland this spring based upon who knows what black box model. And they moved it so far that, you know, Texas City, Lamar, Santa Fe, Alvin, people all lost State Farm insurance. And it's been very difficult for a lot of people. I've had 80-year-old and 90-year-old widows call my office asking for help, saying, I have been to the same building to buy my insurance for 40 and 50 years. And I've never made a claim, or I've made small claims over the period of time. And now State Farm's kicking me out, and I don't know where to go. I haven't done anything different in 40 or 50 years. And so you've got, you know, people. One man from Santa Fe called and said, you know, I was the State Farm agent, Santa Fe's third customer ever. And now they're telling me they don't want me anymore at all. And so that's been very hard, but that just shows you that it's not about the premiums that they could charge. It's about they don't want to insure people at all in some areas.
Well, let's talk briefly about redistricting. You know, the district that was drawn for you, or I should say the district that, well, was drawn for you by the courts, is actually pretty, you know, pretty close to 50-50 based on 2008 returns. As you know, the D.C. court is still thinking about what it's going to do with the, you know, the law, you know, the preclearance lawsuit. You know, what do you think should happen when the court makes its decision? What do you think should happen to your district?
Well, I'm pretty comfortable with the district that I am running in, District 23. Before the last redistricting, I represented District 24, which included Lamarck. And this time, at least in Galveston County, it seems like sanity prevailed, because District 23 was short 17,000 people. I'm using round numbers. And District 24 had about 17,000 too many people, and the city of Lamarck basically as a whole unit solved the problem for both districts, and it kept communities of interest, which is Texas City and Lamarck. I mean, you know, they share a chamber of commerce. Part of Texas City is in Lamarck IFD. Vice versa. And so, and the courts changed, I don't know, they redrew one line when they did the court map. It didn't change any people, but it got a couple of vacant lots or something for whatever reason. So I'm comfortable that nothing's going to change from Galveston and Chambers County. It was Galveston and Chambers County had two representatives before redistricting, and then their growth patterns held that they still fit together and completely are two districts. And the solution of moving Lamar from one to the other fit really well, and so I don't see much changing it. And I'm comfortable because I previously represented the park.
Okay. And, you know, when people go to vote this November, why should they vote you, what vote to send you back to the legislature for what will be, I believe, your 10th term? Why should people vote to reelect you one more time this year and not vote for your opponent?
Right. Well, I think...
Oops.
I think the people should vote for me this fall because, number one, I have proven, especially when we need it most, that I can provide the leadership that the district needs in Austin. I've proven time and time again that I, as a Democrat, I can work with Democrats and Republicans to solve problems. I don't toe anybody's line. I try to do what I think is what is best for both the district and the state. And I try to do it in a bipartisan fashion. Some people might not like that, but I think it's what Texas needs because we all look at Congress and we see gridlock and we see the two parties fighting, and very rarely it seems that people actually try to solve problems and come up with common sense solutions. That's what I try to do. You know, I've been Speaker Tom Craddock appointed me as chairman of the Pension Investment Committee because he wanted to address the teacher retirement system and its long-term viability and actuarial soundness. And, you know, I didn't ask for that committee chairmanship. I didn't want that committee chairmanship. I felt my district at that time needed me on appropriations and insurance, but he told me, look, we have to address this problem. You are the one that can get, you can find a solution and get it passed. And it turns out that by working with Republican Senator Bob Duncan of the Senate, we did find a long-term way to address the pension issues and the teacher retirement system, and it's in much better shape today. So, and then, you know, when Joe Strauss's report was Republican's speaker after Craddock, he appointed me as Speaker Pro Tem, and in the waning session, just because of the way the House works, I ended up presiding over a 3 contentious debate, which all related to the voter ID bill. And tensions were high and tempers were high, and I presided over the House in a fair, even-handed manner. So I think I give those two examples to say and show that I've got things done for the district, and I've done it in what I hope to be a professional and bipartisan way.
Okay. State Representative Craig Island, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Yes, sir. Thank you.